The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Today, Dave, we have a treat. And, you know, when you tell somebody that you're going to be talking to a central banker, a lot of times their eyes will glaze over. But these people are human and some are humble. And this man, Bill White, William White, needs to be listened to. I wish that the central banking community actually would listen to his humility and his understanding of just how little control sometimes people have over a controlled system.
Kevin, in life, we learn from our own mistakes. If we're wise, we learn from the mistakes of others. But it does take a predisposition of humility and openness, a teachability. And, you know, I think what we continue to do on this program is ask questions that will hopefully bring insights into the way the world functions, as it is, perhaps also as we wish it to be, but that conversation has included Harold James and Michael Bordeaux and Barry Eichengreen and Otmar Issing, whether it's on this side of the Atlantic or the other, to try to understand how these complex financial issues come together and what their ultimate impact is for us in our daily lives. It's, you know, as Oscar Wilde said, I wouldn't give a fig for simplicity on this side of complexity, but I'd give my life for simplicity on the other side. Well, and I think that's what we're striving for, is a very clear understanding so that wise decisions can be made by business owners, by individuals, by households, to engage the times that we live in, the changes that are occurring in these time frames, and to do that in a very informed way.
Well, and we live in an environment that is very much controlled by the decisions of central banking. And William White is a man that has all of their ears over on the European side, over on the U.S. side. I mean, going all the way back to the Bank of England, Dave, in 1969, he was in the central banking community when we went off the gold standard, when Nixon closed the gold window in August of 1971.
Now, we talk about the bank for central bankers, the Bank of International Settlements. You know, he spent time there. He spent time with the Bank of England. He spent time with the Bank of Canada, now working with the OECD in Paris. This is, I think, a conversation which will bring a different sort of insight and a helpful one. And so, Mr. White, you know, being the chairman of the Economic Development and Review Committee for the OECD in Paris, and with really a lifetime of central bank experience. You've worked with the Bank of International Settlements in Basel. You have worked with the Bank of England. You've worked with the Bank of Canada. I mean, you look at your life of contribution to the central banking community, and I think you bring an interesting insight. I have many questions for you that hopefully will bring clarity for our listeners where we're at and where we're going. To set the stage, let's discuss the nature of the problem we face today. You know, starting with unnaturally easy monetary policies, we've had them in place for years, maybe even decades, there is this boom to bust cycle. Intervention following the bust periods really creating the next stage, if you will, of a boom to bust cycle. Am I wrong in thinking that there is more at stake in each of these successive boom and bust cycles?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. My sense of it is that there was, in a way, a kind of fundamental misinterpretation of Keynesian policies in the post-war period. And I think a lot of people in a lot of countries followed very activist demand-stimulating policies whenever they saw the economy turning down. But what I think was missing was a sense of the sort of the unintended consequences of some of those policies, particularly monetary policy. And so what was happening was that in the downturn, you sort of never sort of cleaned out the undergrowth. And then the sort of easy policies generated a new upturn, often based on increased asset prices and things of that nature. And I think the problems really have been the problems of debt. I mean, if you want to summarize it in one word, the problems of debt have been sort of building up really for the last, in a serious way, I think, for at least the last 20 years. So if we're here at the end of this long period of accumulating difficulties, it's not so hard to imagine that sorting the whole thing out is not going to be a quick process, because it's taken a long time to build up. So I'm concerned that we still have significant problems arising from this source, you know, debt and, you know, bad debt and various kinds of imbalances, not least, as we see today, very high asset prices in many respects, equity prices worldwide. So I am concerned that we're still in a very vulnerable position.
Well, I mean, the IMF and the World Bank are very optimistic in their 2014 growth estimates. I think you would assume we've not fully recovered. You know, you mentioned that the BIS now, the Bank of International Settlements estimates are currently that the G20 countries are 30% more in debt than before the crisis. So very little deleveraging has occurred. Now we have the Fed's tapering or the reduction of asset purchases. That's put the emerging markets on edge. Of course, that started last spring, has continued through to the present. So debt focuses front and center. We have had the asset price appreciation. Most people are saying, well, that's reason to be happy. There's no reason to be concerned. It appears that things have indeed recovered.
Well, I think there's a big difference between the impact of these ultra-easy monetary policies, the impact on the financial side of the economy as opposed to the impact on the real side of the economy. And on the financial side of the economy, I mean, clearly, you know, when you look at bond levels, at least for countries that are not sort of, you know, considered to be shaky sovereigns, but, you know, countries like the U.S. and Germany and whatever, I mean, the long bond rates are very low. Spreads, generally speaking, for junk and things of that nature are very low. The VIX for up until very, very recently was very low, indicating, you know, no worries. Asset prices were very high, thinking particularly about equity prices, you know, relative to long-term earnings and stuff like that. And to me, I mean, all of these things, and also, I mean, the recovery, you know, Covlite and all this stuff that's come back again. To me, I think there's a lot of similarities between what's going on today and what we saw in 2007. So that doesn't make me feel, you know, overly optimistic. Now, if that optimism in the financial markets was based on a clear indication that the global economy was recovering and was heading back up towards levels of output and growth that it exhibited before, I guess I might say, well, yeah, you know, the financial markets have got ahead of themselves, but that, you know, the real side's catching up. But honestly, I mean, I don't really see it. The problem, in a way, and I think this is a deep problem that deserves more discussion, is that investment, you know, in the advanced market economies has been very weak for a long period of time. And it appears to be almost impervious to the stimulus given by these easy monetary policies. You know, so corporations are sitting on huge amounts of cash. But they're basically using the cash to pay out dividends and buy in stock. But what they're not using it for anywhere, I mean, as you look around the advanced market economies, they're not using it to put structures on the ground. So we're just not seeing the real side. And once you get this big disconnect between the real side and the financial side, you know, eventually the connection has to come. But the connection seems to me to be more likely to arrive in the form of a reversal of those financial market movements that we've seen. Now, I would hope, but it is just a hope, that the real side would behave as the IMF and, for that matter, the World Bank and the OECD expect. But their track record, and I say this with some respect to the OECD, which employs me at least part-time, you know, they would be the first to admit that their track record has been pretty poor. They keep waiting for this sort of rush back to equilibrium levels of output, but it just hasn't happened. And then the question is, well, why should we believe them this time?
So the financial side is really where the impact of those ultra-loose monetary policies has been felt. It was, I think, Richard Cantillon a couple hundred years ago who was attributed sort of the Cantillon effect. First, you have asset price inflation, and then on a lagging basis, consumer price inflation. I don't know if that holds or not, but do you have any concerns with consumer price inflation?
I do know that Ben Bernanke was very explicit when he introduced QE2, that the purpose of the exercise was to get the asset prices up, to make people feel wealthier, and then the spending would trickle down and everybody would get the benefit. Well, I'm not sure that that process is, in fact, happening or is going to happen. Now, to take the process one stage further, let's suppose that it did happen, that you did have easy money having the desired effect on the real side of the economy. Would that, in the fullness of time, lead to inflation? And I know a lot of people, particularly in the United States, have been, worrying for ages that the Fed's policy was an invitation to hyperinflation even. I frankly think the likelihood of that is pretty low. One, because we don't see the policy working on the real economy in quite the same way that it might normally do. I think that people can sort of see through, in his sense, what's going on here, and they're sort of not really buying in that there's something real. You know, this whole thing has been a bit sort of illusory, the gains in the stock market. But if the economy really were to recover, then I guess I would worry more about inflation, but I'm not sort of very worried about inflation, because I guess my sense of it is that the relationship between sort of rates of growth of money and credit and inflation are actually pretty unsure. And in a situation where there's still a lot of excess capacity, it's less likely that problems will arise. Now, having said that, one of the difficulties that I think we underestimate, but I'm not quite sure by how much, is the possibility that a lot of potential output might have disappeared over the course of the last few years. You know, the usual business about, you know, long-term unemployed, leaving the labor market, depreciating capital, it's not being replaced, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think for many, the increase in the adjusted monetary base over the five-year period, 2009 to the present, from less than $800 billion to now just shy of $4 trillion, yes, inflation expectations remain, as the Fed likes to say, well anchored. But would this be the case if velocity were not so depressed, four-decade lows? Can we assume this will remain the case with velocity this low?
No. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've been skeptical for years about the suggestions that inflationary expectations remain well anchored. And what they mean by that is that they're well anchored in people's knowledge of the Fed's future targets and the ECB's future targets. You know, that's what's anchoring everything. I've been skeptical of that for a long time, because I think that probably what it reflects is just the fact that inflation has been low, so that, you know, it's the history that's driven it. I also believe that it is not impossible, as you put it, it is not impossible that an environment of faster real growth, that those expectations could turn pretty quickly. And I think we've had lots of experience of this kind of thing, for example, in Latin America. I don't want to suggest that we're all, you know, turning like Latin America 20, 30 years ago. But there's certainly plenty of examples where relatively minor shocks had big impact on people's expectations. And then the inflationary thing really started to move. So I don't think it's likely, but it's certainly not impossible.
Going back to the issue of potential output potentially being lost, we have low rates, which have essentially recapitalized the banking system, and some have called that, you know, sort of financial repression. Is it wrong to assume that low rates are really just a policy effort redirecting capital to some from others, from household savings to sort of the subsidizing of national debt, et cetera, et cetera? If so, isn't this a part of the loss in output, choosing winners and losers and putting sort of the household sector at a disadvantage?
Yeah, well, I wrote a paper about a year ago, I think, which was called Ultra-Easy Monetary Policy and the Law of Unintended Consequences. And in that paper, I mean, I pointed out a lot of the things that can go wrong with these kinds of policies. Certainly, you know, going back to the beginning of this conversation, for example, about, you know, one bubble bust then just leading to the next one and cumulatively getting worse and worse. But you also have big effects on the real side of the economy, too, from these kinds of policies, so that, you know, that a lot of the zombie companies being kept alive, zombie banks, that sort of really interferes with what I think is one of the most important processes that takes place in the capitalist economy, which is, you know, like in a forest, you have to have companies exiting, okay, dying and exiting, and then you have to have companies entering and providing new initiatives and new sort of ways of looking at things, and, you know, the creative destruction of Joseph Schumpeter And I think that's really, really important. One of the side effects of these very easy monetary policies is that it's very easy for banks to evergreen loans and to keep the zombies on the books. And as long as that's happening and they're not really focusing on the new guys aren't getting any money, and then we have an underlying problem. The other thing that I worry about, I just had a small part of my paper was about this, but I've become more and more concerned about it since, which is the distributional aspects of all of this, and I think you were alluding to that. And on the basis of my reading, I mean, it seems to me that what's happening with these very low rates is that it's helping the poorest, if you want to put it that way, who are people who got debts but very few assets. Okay, so the lower interest rate is good for them. It also helps the rich people who are the ones most engaged in speculation. So they're borrowing at very low interest rates, leveraging themselves up and buying those assets whose prices have gone through the roof, as we were talking about a few moments ago. So these people are coming out of this gangbusters. And who's getting hammered in the middle? It's the middle classes who've got some financial assets and whose assets are significantly greater than their liabilities. But these are people who are essentially, what's the word? The risk avoiders, okay? Guys like me, where the money's essentially in the bank or in some sort of riskless form. And there, of course, the rates of return that they're getting are very, very low. And anybody who's a debtor, okay, on the other side of this equation, anybody who's a debtor is actually doing very well at the expense of the creditors. And that's a form of repression because the government, of course, is the biggest debtor of them all, right?
That's right, the U.S. government. And it would seem that that does put pressure on the status quo. We have a world monetary system, as you describe it, a non-system, which I appreciate, the nature of which is now coming into conflict with national interests. I mean, we are the largest debtor nation in the world. It is to our advantage to do as we have done from a policy standpoint, keep very low rates. That is at the expense of our creditors. Perhaps they appreciate liquidity and liquidity only. But at some point, isn't there another factor or other factors that enter in to the creditor's mind?
Well, you know, Larry Summers once, this is a number of years ago, he referred to this whole thing as the sort of the balance of financial terror. And the implication being with something like a balance of terror, it's very, very difficult to tell in which direction the balance might come unstuck. So you've got all of these people, you know, the Chinese and others who are sitting on trillions of dollars worth of reserves, and their expectation probably is that the value of those things is likely to go down and they don't like it. But, of course, any actions that they take to stop purchasing U.S. treasuries, particularly in the context of the need for financing for the flow of current account deficit in the U.S., the minute that they stop withdrawing their support, this pushes the dollar down, which, of course, instigates the losses that they're trying to avoid. Do you follow me?
Absolutely.
So it's very hard to know how this thing will sort itself out. I mean, I suspect what will happen is, and it's already happening, is that foreigners are sort of trying to get down the proportion of the assets, their foreign exchange reserve assets that they hold in dollars. And I think you can see this in the IMF numbers, and, you know, they talk all the time, too, about increased purchases of gold and stuff like that. But it's all being done sort of very quietly at the margins because they know that if they do anything, you know, to suddenly withdraw from purchases of dollars, or worse, I mean, to start selling them and buying something else, they just start the crisis they're trying to avoid. Now, you never know, because there's always these free riders, you know, who say, well, everybody else is going to stay stuck so I can get out. But I think it'll all be done very, very cautiously, particularly since when you start saying, well, you know, this sort of cautious movement out of dollars, what are you going to go into? And the answer is, it is not exceedingly obvious, right? Because the euro still got its problems, Japan still got its problems, China's still controlled by capital controls. You know, what do you do?
What they have done is move from agency paper to treasuries and then gradually improved their maturity structure so they're not taking very much interest rate. So risk. So they've cleaned up on the credit quality side, then cleaned up on the maturity side. And it puts us in an awkward position as a debtor with some of our primary creditors holding a lot of paper that matures, you know, in a short period of time. You know, it reminds me of the old 1980s movie with Jane Fonda, Rollover.
Okay, I know I don't remember that movie, but anything that had Jane Fonda in it in those days is good enough for me.
It was basically the story of petrodollars and the rolling of debt obligations, which one day just stopped. They weren't interested in renewing that loan, and we were in a real pickle. At a sovereign level, basically what we saw at the corporate level back in 2008, where rollover risk was concentrated, and liquidity crisis led to, frankly, the destabilization of the world financial system.
Yeah, well, I've got something in that paper that I wrote last year about the unexpected consequences on this. And in principle, you know, if you might have expected under the circumstances, whether due to the creditor being frightened and wanting a short maturity or the U.S. Treasury basically saying it's much cheaper at the short end, let's get the maturity down. The truth of the matter seems to be, at least the last time I looked at the numbers, is that the average maturity, but this is about a year ago, so maybe it's changed. The average maturity in the Treasury market had actually gone up by a reasonable amount, which at the time I said was good because I identified in the paper, I think, the kind of phenomenon that you're just referring to. So you can imagine a situation if the debt of the Treasury gets short enough that the Fed is trying to tighten up monetary policy and they raise interest rates. But then something funny happens because the increase in the interest rates raises the debt service so much because the debt maturity is so short that people start to worry that the government deficit is now going to get much bigger very fast. And as soon as they start to believe that, then basically they start heading for the hills because they think that financial repression will be the order of the day. And then you can have a huge crisis.
Last year, the White House estimated the interest line item at about $250 billion. And we finished fiscal year 2013 at 415, about a 60% underestimation.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you're talking about. Of course, 415 is still manageable. Let's talk about re-regulation. You've had periods of liberalization in the financial markets, which seem to be followed by crisis and then re-regulation. Brown Brothers Harriman, I think, demonstrates the difference between limited liability in the financial sector and unlimited liability, which their directors have. Is a change in business structure sufficient to engage that sort of self-regulation instead of re-regulation of the entire system?
Well, I've just written a big paper on that, actually, which is just on the broad question of the prudential regulation of financial institutions. And a version of it is going to be published here shortly by the OECD as a working paper. What I suggest in that paper is that this sort of wholesale re-regulation that we're doing, we should be a bit suspicious because, frankly, as I look at it and as I think many other academics and others look at it, the analytical foundations to support most of the measures that are being recommended, in fact, are not very solid, or at least there's still a lot of thoughtful people who are basically questioning them. So that makes me sort of worried about the role of regulation and supervision. Well, then what you're thrown back to is the other two ways to do it. And I guess one of them is self-regulation, and the other one is market discipline. And I think that there's a lot to be said for putting more emphasis on both of those things. So if you want to talk about self-discipline, I think, you know, if we could somehow restore that sense of fiduciary responsibility for client welfare that used to be common, in fact, it used to be de rigueur, but somehow seems to have disappeared, if we could change the pay incentives that encourage nearsighted investment strategies, stronger legal sanctions, I think all sorts of people probably should have gone to prison. I mean, there's certainly a lot more people went to jail after the SNL thing than has happened thus far this time, although it looks now as if they're getting tougher. So changes in the fundamental strategy, the business model. So as you suggest, getting rid of limited liability. I think John Gutfreund at one point sort of said to Michael Lewis that he was of the view that that's where it all started to go wrong. That if these guys knew that they were going to lose everything, they would behave in a much more prudent fashion. So, yeah, I think we need to go back and think more about self-discipline. And I think market discipline could be improved, too. And there, I think we're sort of moving towards it, you know, getting more transparency out about what individual parties are doing, who they're doing it with. Now, I may be overestimating how far we can go on that front, but anyway, I guess the point I want to make is that there's these three pillars. There's the regulatory discipline, the self-discipline, and the market discipline. And I think we may have overemphasized the first of those and underestimated the latter two or three.
You know, it's generally conceived by the public that the central bank community is, I mean, you look at the Fed, for instance, 600 PhDs or more on staff, and, you know, these are the best and brightest. They have brought us through their activism from the brink of financial disaster. They may or may not have created sort of sustainable growth with, you know, economic growth with what they've put in motion. But should we, the common man, view the central bank community as scientists, sort of operating with a very clear understanding of the highly complex financial system?
Well, I wrote a paper here, which was just published a month or two ago in a European volume of essays. And it was called, Is Monetary Policy a Science? Theory and Practice Over the Last 50 Years. And my very clear conclusion, similar as it were to the analytical underpinnings of the regulatory side, is that the analytical underpinnings of what we do is actually pretty shaky. And as a reflection of that fact, virtually every aspect you can think of with respect to monetary policy, you know, about best practice, has changed and changed repeatedly over the course of the last 50 years. So this stuff ain't science. In addition, of course, I mean, when we think about what's been happening recently, of course, one, it's completely unprecedented, okay, what's been going on here recently. People are making it up as they go along, okay? This is hardly science, you know, building on the pillars of the past. And secondly, what they've been sort of making up as they go along is actually differs quite a bit across the central banks. So they can't even agree amongst themselves about what's the best way to do things. So is monetary policy a science? No, I don't think so. I'm becoming more and more convinced that all of the models that we use are basically useless. And I've become much taken in the last little while really by sort of complexity economics. And I guess what I mean by that is that all of the models we've used for the last 100 years of the macro type models are all based on sort of people optimizing the use of resources to produce stuff. And it treats the economy as like a kind of machine. You know, you got a machine that produces cookies. Well, you push stuff in at one end and the cookies come out reliably, always the same at the other end. And that's the way the models are built. And it ain't like that. As I say, I'm becoming more and more convinced that the best way to look at it is that the economy is not a machine, but it's a living organism. It's an ecosystem, you know, where things compete. Some live, some die, some grow, some don't. But it's a system in which there's no equilibrium as such, because it's constantly growing. So as somebody said, the only equilibrium in a forest is when everything's dead. And that's not something that we sort of would look forward to. So I really think that the whole way that we look at things, the whole of the analytical framework needs to be seriously rethought. And I guess what sort of surprised me, in a sense, is that we've had this huge crisis that the mainstream absolutely didn't predict. It has gone on for years, which the mainstream absolutely didn't predict. I would have thought this would have been a basis for a fundamental rethink about what we used to think we believed, okay? But it hasn't happened. I mean, what's happened is that the policies that we followed, on the monetary side at least, since 2007, are just more of the same, ostensibly demand-stimulating policies that we've been following, I think, erroneously for the last 30 years. So far from having said, gee whiz, we've got to think this one through right from the basics, it's just more of the same. And I found that worrisome. Daniel Kahneman, by the way, you know, the Nobel Prize winner, the psychologist, he contends, and I think it's in his book, but I can't remember, but he contends that, in fact, this is absolutely part of human nature. It's not just central bankers. That whenever people are confronted with stuff that really challenges them, and they said, how did that happen? I never expected it. What they do, far from questioning it, is they retreat into the old belief system. And this seems to be a trait of human nature, according to Kahneman. So that the Germans basically believe the only thing to worry about is hyperinflation, and that originally comes out of two big government deficits. So now we got to stop all that, and that's what they're doing. And of course, in the United States, fundamental problem is deflation and the Great Depression, and we got to stop all that, and that's what we're doing. So it's sort of a bit surprising and worrisome. but I think there's an element of truth in it.
Bill, you were on the cusp of change when you began at the Bank of England in the late 1960s and early 70s. This was the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system. We had been off the gold standard. That was sort of probably your most extreme version of a rules-based system. The Bretton Woods replaced it. It was also rules-based. Then we transitioned to a discretion-oriented set of policies, you know, I don't know if it's fair to say globally amongst your central bankers, but you've watched major changes occur. Is it sufficient for the pendulum to swing back to the rules-based types of systems, or what would you say in terms of reflecting on what you've seen, what you've lived through, the changes that have occurred and the changes that still need to occur?
You know, when I started at the Bank of England in 1969, my 3 years there were leading up to some really, really big changes in the UK where they were sort of deregulating and they had this thing called competition and credit control. And so that was huge change for them, and it ended up badly. And then I went to the Bank of Canada, and they'd just given up on the fixed exchange rate system because that was working badly. So then we had a floating rate system, and the question is, what was to be the domestic anchor? And so they started off by saying, well, we'll focus on the unemployment rate, almost like you're doing in the States today, okay? And that worked out very badly because it turned out that the unemployment rate was shifting downwards because of changes in the unemployment insurance and stuff, and we didn't pick it up, and that ended badly. So then we went to monetarism, you know, set targets for the money supply. That ended badly. And so it continues. I mean, I guess the point that I want to make here is that our understanding of how this complex adaptive system works is actually very limited, and that perhaps instead of sort of focusing so much on the technicalities of the best way to do this or to do that, maybe we should be really just thinking about the plausibility or whether, in fact, our ambitions about control are too ambitious for the knowledge that we have. And maybe instead of sort of trying to maximize all the time, we should be much less ambitious. And it's the difference between a dentist and a doctor. You know, Mervyn King reminded us of something that Keynes said once, where he wanted central bankers and economists eventually to be thought about people who were just sort of honest tradesmen, okay, and like dentists. My sense of it is that we ought to be like doctors. We have the potential to do so much harm through not getting the creation of fiat, credit, and money right. We've got the capacity to do so much harm that we should be focusing much more on making sure that doesn't happen. To go back to the literature about sort of complex systems, you know, we're always worried about efficiency. You know, whatever the organism is, it's got to be efficient. It's got to be able to survive. But it's also got to be stable and resilient. And the species that have actually done that are the ones that don't just, they got some combination of the capacity to cope today with some capacity to cope to unexpected surprises, to cope tomorrow. And that's where I don't think we're spending enough time in economics. There ought to be a lot more effort. There should have been an awful lot more effort. And I think this still applies, actually, to thinking about possibilities of systemic instability and what we can do about it.
The market is resilient, and it is an adaptive, as you describe, organism. What you're saying reminds me of Hayek's Nobel lecture, talking about the pretense of knowledge.
You know, the thought went through my mind and I didn't express it, but I mean, that's precisely who I would go back to, really, was that speech in 1974. This is a quote from my paper. Perhaps the most pernicious aspect of the belief system of the academic community was that macroeconomics was a science and that economic processes could be modeled using quantitative data, establishing relationships between a small number of variables. The problem, as Hayek put it, quote unquote, for essentially complex phenomena, the events to be explained for which we can obtain quantitative data are necessarily limited and may not include the important ones. And I think that's absolutely spot on. So, we don't know enough to be sure that we can maximize anything. So I think if that's the case, you ought to set your sights a little bit lower and make sure you don't do any really serious harm. As we've shown many times in the past, we can do if we put our mind to it.
That's the doctor's creed, first do no harm.
Yep, the Hippocratic Oath.
thank you for joining the conversation and adding your insights from decades of experience as a central banker. We hope that for future generations, we do get it right, and we begin with perhaps more of a posture of humility as we seek to recognize what we know, what we don't know, and take account for everything that we think that we know, and which could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to bring a long career to an end by never again having to say, I'm sorry, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Thank you, Mr. White.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, William White. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.